meant as much to the people from the flatlands as it has to any other group of people. If you look at the statistics, why, you note that there are almost more people coming from the state of Minnesota to Holden Village than from any other state, except maybe Washington. So from that you can gather that we forecast that this would be true. When we thought about Holden development, we thought that the people from the Midwest would appreciate this place more than anyone else. And the people from Texas, too, the people who don't have mountains, for instance. So I think this village has meant a great deal to the people that... I remember the first year, many of them had never seen a mountain before that came from Minnesota. And we had to cover them up as we hauled them up from the lake in the truck, because they would be, well, they just went berserk when they looked over the side of that truck. And we had some problems with those people. One of the women declared that she wouldn't ever go back that road again. So what we did, we put her in the bottom of the back of this huge truck, and we covered her with a blanket. And that's the way we got her down. Yesterday I was privileged to hear Mary Schramm in the orientation speech that she gave. That was right here too. And she covered this, the past history of Holden, beautifully. So I'm not going to cover anything that she touched on. She, of course, could have talked all afternoon about the Holden development and not have covered it. But my little segment here is going to be with respect to the first 4 years of the development. And as we only have about a half an hour or so to do it, well, I'm going to have to get on my horse and get going. So I'd ask you to imagine that you were part of the feasibility committee that studied whether or not to accept Holden as a gift. I received a message, a telephone message one morning, an early day in June, informing me that they would like to have me as a member of the feasibility committee that would go to Holden and appraise the village. There had been a committee of LBI people, the president and several faculty members, along with Wes Preeb and one of the students, that came up a week previous to my coming here. And they had come up in response to the telephone message that Wes Preeb got from headquarters in New York, that the gift was available to LBI. And so they came up here to see what this gift was all about. And they come up and they were amazed at what they saw up here. But they became afraid of it. It looked like it was something that LBI could never handle. So they took it up with the district, the Northwest District of the ALC, that was in session the first week in June. And there they determined that it was necessary that the village be appraised by some practical people that would come here and see what it was all about. And so one day in early June, I got a message on the telephone saying that they would like to have me as a member of that committee. And that committee consisted of Victor Nelson. I had never met him before. It was Ed Autumn, another man that I had never met before, and Earl Van Kirk from Kent, an electrician. I'd never met him before. I had barely met Nathan Stein, the son of the president of LBI. So he was the only one that I knew anything about. But this was an opportunity for me to become acquainted with some very fine people. They came to my house early in the morning, about 4:30 o'clock in the morning, and we took off in Victor Nelson's old Borgward, which was a threatened species at that time. We had a lot of fun coming over the pass that morning, We first of all had to get acquainted. We were not acquainted with one another, and so this was an opportunity. We set out in a very light mood, but we knew that we had a serious project before us. And I'll not tell you much about our journey over here, driving through the Wenatchee Valley. You know, we'd been there many times before. We knew something about it, the orchard line slopes and the lake and all of that. We'd been up the lake many times. We'd vacationed there, so I was well acquainted with that part of it. But I'd never been to Holden, although I'd heard an awful lot about it because I had friends here, an engineer and his wife that lived here, and I'd heard a lot about Holden, what a wonderful place it was. It was the finest mining village in the world. And when we reached Luzerne, there we rented Oscar Getty's car. And Oscar Getty was very helpful in the development here. He had some transport equipment that we needed. We didn't have it. And he was very glad to let us use his car. And we came up here, and we reached here one afternoon. I think it was a Saturday afternoon, about 1 o'clock. And we had lunch together. And we sat on the steps of house number one over there and ate our lunch. And we were quite taken by what we saw out before us. It was a ghost town, a village that had been abandoned 3 years earlier. And it was our privilege then to have lunch there and to thank God for the opportunity that we had to come here and appraise this property in behalf of the Lutheran Church. And so we took one after the other of these houses. We first went through number one, a very fine residence. It has a basement, and it has three floors above the basement. The basement interested me very much because I was interested in the structural worth of the buildings here. So I took out my jackknife and jabbed it into some of the structural timbers under that house. And I noticed right away that these timbers were just as sound as the day they were built. And the posts and all were in excellent condition. They had been sawn from live timber that came out of the forest right back of number one. So we went through this very fine cottage, and it was in terrible shape. The dust that had accumulated over 3 years was on everything, and the tracks that mice and rats leave were everywhere. It was a stinking mess. And on the living room floor, there was a couple of mattresses that indicated that some hikers had overnighted there. And then we took number two, number three. We inspected the fire equipment in front of number three. We were quite amazed. The fire equipment there was, the hose was like new. The nozzles and the axes and all the fire tools were there, and we noted in our book that this was very fine. We turned on a valve. Nothing happened. There was no water. That indicated that all the mains in the village were empty. There was no water pressure. There wasn't a drop of water in the village. Then we took in turn all of the houses on the, I think John called it the Chalet Lane. Is that the official name of that street now?
Oh, Chalet Hill.
Chalet Hill. And it should have a name, as this should have a name too. I don't know if they call it Main Street. I've never been able to identify these streets because they haven't been officially named. But we took them, and we found in each case, we went from room to room, every room and every closet we inspected from basement to attic to determine whether it was a soundly built house. And we had already been impressed by the design of the village buildings. They were all in keeping with the Alpine setting. And then we took the hospital, and that was the most interesting place to visit. There was a lot of hospital supplies left there, and the operating room was in shape except for the lights. The operating table was there, and it could have told a story if we'd wanted it to. about all the people that had been born in that hospital and all the people that had died there. And we were, I think, in a mood where we would like to have read the history of Holden just from what we saw. Every step we took, it seemed like a new chapter in the Holden Village story. And we took in turn the four chalets. We covered all floors of those. And there again, we inspected the underpinnings and noticed that structurally they were just as sound as ever. But they were filthy. They showed 20 years of wear, and they had left the buildings in a very filthy condition. But you know, conditions of a building is like beauty. It's only skin deep. We could see through the filth and the mouse tracks and all of this filth and dust, and could see that there here was something that had been built for a long time to come. And that meant that it was quality. In the hotel, we walked through the kitchen first of all and noticed that it had an old dishwasher, and it had a lot of power equipment to knead the bread and to grind different things. It had a big electric bake oven. It had two huge oil-burning ranges, restaurant type. They were so huge, and they were so completely covered with grease and dust that you'd been ashamed of them. And then we walked into the dining room and saw all those polished coffee urns, and we determined that all the miners must have been very fond of coffee. And you can see those today. They're still up there, and I hope they'll always be there. And the tables were all set. The miners and the people that worked in the village had left the village so suddenly that they had figured, well, maybe there was going to be a next meal, so the tables were all set. And this impressed us very much. And we went through the upper floors, and they were in filthy condition, as you can imagine, after 3 years. A lot of windows were broken out. Yesterday, I think Mary indicated that there were 400 missing windows. The windows weren't missing, but the glass was. And instead of 400 windows, there were 800. So she can make that little correction in her little speech. I'm not finding fault with Mary's speech, because she does a very beautiful job. And then we looked over. Well, this building was just a dormitory at that time, and it was partially dismantled. The plumbing equipment, many of the basins were out. And the other building behind here, I think it's called Dorm 6, that was the store, the old store, and the meat market. We walked into the walk-in freezer. There was a huge thing, and it was mouse-proof. And in there we saw all the blankets and all the sheets that had been left here were intact and stacked neatly in that mouse-proof container. Later on, about, I suppose, a month or two later, we came back and they were all gone. A pack train had come in from the west side of the mountains, mind you. We found this out later on, and had removed all the blankets and all the sheets. And of course there was evidence that we had seen evidence down below that people had been here and lifted a number of things. Like these captain's chairs are very valuable. We were lucky to have those here, because they were being picked off one at a time by the people that came here on the ghost town tours. And then we looked over the big building, and oh, we were amazed at that. What a tremendous facility for a retreat. But it too was in bad shape. There's a lot of plumbing in there. We could see right away that the plumbing had been destroyed by frost. And there were a lot of hidden plumbing in the village that we couldn't test because there was no water. But we knew enough about building to know that there would be sag places in the plumbing where the water would collect and would freeze and would expand and break the pipe. And later on we found out that every time we opened a shutoff valve to any one of these buildings, the water came out of not only the faucets, but out of the ceilings and out of the walls because of all the frost damage that had been done. And the schoolhouse. Oh, that was a mess. I'm sure that a great many people had been there that had been frustrated in their school days, and they'd take it out on that little schoolhouse. The ink was daubed all over the walls and all over the floors, and it was really a mess, and they'd knocked out a lot of windows there. But structurally, it was like the other buildings. They were all sound, and this meant a great deal to us. We also took in the mine level and the village up above before we left the next day. And we were amazed to find that village up there. Later on, the Forest Service wanted us to take that village over and that it should be a part of the whole Holden Village package. But we said no to that because the buildings there were not built like these were built. They were built by the people that lived there, and many of them were jackknife carpenters, and they didn't have the right pitch on the roofs, and many of them were caved in from the tremendous weight of winter ice and snow. At the mine level, the mill building was still standing. It was complete in every respect, but the buildings above it, the machine shops, and the other buildings up there, the change room and all of that had been, the roofs had been taken off, first of all, and the winter had caved those in. So they were a terrific mess. And sadly enough, we inspected the electrical system up there and found that the transformers were missing. And our electrician member of the feasibility committee said, that would be a tremendous job to replace those and bring the electricity in from Manson, where it had formerly come from. It would require an expenditure of maybe $50,000 to $60,000 just to replace the transformer. And that became a study later on. This was one of the main problems then that confronted us, was how we were to restore the electrical system. And we walked up to the water intake at Copper Creek Falls. And if you haven't been up there, you should go, because that's a very important place to this village. That's where our water comes from, for fighting fires and for drinking and the whole thing. And the water tank. The water tank was full of water, and there was some damage up there. Some of the valves were frozen. And the water was shut off, and we didn't dare to turn the valves on to the village because we had no way of knowing whether the pipes here would hold water or not. Well, that rather completed our hasty survey of the village. We didn't come here with the idea of setting any dollar value on this place. The night we spent in House 1 was a very important night. We had discussed there way after dark what we had seen, and we evaluated this village from one end to the other and listed the positive and the negative side of it, and determined that it would be a tremendous job to restore this village. It was in filthy conditions. You realize that the streets already, nature had taken over. The gutters were full of little trees growing up about so high, and the lawns were stomped full of holes by horses and deer and bear and the other animals that come into the village. But we went away from here with a positive feeling that this place had something for the Lutheran Church in the future. I would say that if we had put our evaluation into a computer, we would have come out about 45% negative and 55% positive. I think I was probably the most positive one member of that feasibility committee, because I think I was more acquainted with the Lutheran Church than my fellow members were. I had been involved in Minneapolis, headquarters of the church. I had been in Luther League work, And I had been on the union committee that unionized the three or four Lutheran churches. And I had a lot of background with people that I knew that would be important to this development, like the leaders of the youth department. I knew them by their first name. And so I felt that if we could get certain key people involved in this thing, it would go. We had to have a program here that would match the setting and would match the facilities that are here. This was a three-pronged development. The facilities here, the setting was another thing, and the program was another thing. And the program, I think, was the most important, and it took certain people to put that over. So we went home and we called a meeting of not only the people that were along with me in this first feasibility study, but we enlarged the committee to take in people that were experts in every field, like in plumbing, in electrical, in heating, and the roads, the sewers, and all of these things had to have people here that knew something about it. Another thing we had to determine, first of all, was what about this gift? All we had to go on was a telephone call from New York stating that the gift was available if under certain conditions. But we had no legal word from them that it was available. And we also knew that the Forest Service that owns the ground on which we are standing would have a say as to whether or not we could accept the gift. They would have to okay anything that we would do here. The gift included the mine properties. We could get a deed to that, but to this we only own the buildings that stand on Forest Service grounds. So we knew we had to have the okay. One of the first things we determined was to visit with the Forest Service people in Wenatchee. And we sat down with the head of the Forest Service there, and he was very cooperative. He encouraged us. Really, he was a very key person as far as we were concerned in okaying this. He said that there had been people that wanted to take this village over, that they didn't want them because they were commercial type people that would bring people in here that would smoke and drink, and they would damage the environment, and they didn't want that type of people in here. And he knew something about the Lutheran Church, and he said, you are the people that should have it. And it seems like God's hand was really in this thing from the very beginning. What Wes Preed did in writing to these people has got to be something that God did for us. And what the development that took place and the people that were challenged, that too was just as much of a miracle as the gift. So we enlarged that committee, and we brought people up here that were experts in these different fields, and I brought the former city engineer up here and went over the sewer system and the water system, and he explained everything. He had had charge of this village for some time. And he indicated that everything was in good shape as far as we could see it. Of course, there were a lot of hidden pipes that we had to test later on. But we did have to get these key program people involved. And I knew Dr. Merton Strum real well. He was a close friend of mine. I knew that if I could get his okay, we were far along on the road to development. So at a meeting in Minneapolis, I told him about this place. I showed him pictures of it. He says, I'll come out at the very first opportunity and go up there with you. And he promised that he would introduce the subject to Dr. Bergstrand, who became a very key person in this thing, and Elmer Witt, and some of the other youth people that we knew about. So one after the other, we brought them into the village. Merton Strum and I took him up here, gave him a tour of the village, and when that was over, we stood right outside of the wrecked building there, And I says, Merton, what do you think about this? Do you think this is something that the Lutheran Church can use? He says, this is a miracle. He says, this is something that the youth of the church, if no one else, needs this place. This is something that's completely different from anything that's ever come into the church. So with his okay, I thought we were pretty far along. And then later on, Dr. Bergstrand, but he couldn't come out until in November. And at that time, the village was snowed in. So I put him on a plane, and we flew him over the mountains from Seattle and over the village. We circled within this valley here a number of times. He looked down on the village. He says, from what I can see, he says, you and Merton are right. This is something we want. And later on, Elmer Witt came up here. And then we thought that we have to bring more people in here. So we chartered buses and brought 40 and 50 people at a time. We chartered the little speedway boat and took them up here earlier in the day than the regular boat would arrive. And we took them on tours, and we fed them a big chicken dinner on the gym floor, and gave them a tour of the village. And I would say that about 90% of the people that we brought up here were in favor of accepting the gift. And that went on for quite a while. And I called New York and got written documentation that the gift was available. And so this put us on the road. This continued during that summer. The committee, we developed the development council with, we broke down the responsibility into about 8 different segments, plumbing, heating, and electrical, and all of these different phases of the work that had to be done here was put under charge by experts in their field. And we brought them up here sometimes 2 and 3 at a time. And they were quite amazed. And so it went on that summer. And we, LBI was very cooperative. They gave permission for us to accept the gift in their name, and that they would later on transfer the title to the properties to a new corporation. So this is what we had to do next, was to develop a corporation that would sponsor this development. This was accomplished, and I would say that Vern Rieke lent a big hand in doing this. Vern Rieke has been a very big key person in the development of Holden Village. He was on the board here until just a year or two ago, I believe. All those years. He was a great help to us in providing the legal talent that we needed for this development. We then had to set up a bank account. We had no money. We had all this tremendous gift, but we had no money and no sponsoring organization. So this was the big miracle that took place. We brought in the help that we needed to develop it. We brought these development people in here. And first thing you know, we had a legal corporation. And we also started to gather funds. And we called for help, people to come into the village the next year. And the youth departments were very cooperative in this respect. They sent out a call for volunteers to come into the village in 1961. And at that time, we were ready for them. We already had a truck. Later on, we had another truck. And later on, a bus. And when that first work camper crew came into the village, we had purposely left everything untouched so that they could see the village at its worst. There wasn't a single toilet in operation. There was no electrical energy in the village. There was just nothing. There was just a filthy village, a ghost town. And we wanted them to see it as it is. As it was at that time. And they spent 1 month here. And the first month we spent chasing the rats and the mice out of the village and the other animals and cleaning it up. We replaced something like 800 windows that, or window panes that first year. And we had to rebuild a number of chimneys. The hotel chimney was down because no one had been here to shovel the snow away from back of the chimney. And there was a mason amongst that first work camper group. And we put on a crew to do that. We had a lot of work to do on the roads. We had fire wood to cut because we had to do all our cooking on a little stove in house number one and in the fireplace back of it. We had no refrigeration. So we had to bring in our food a little bit at a time. And these people were really hungry. Believe me, these young people that came from these many states had an appetite that you just wouldn't believe. But we worked hard and we played hard and we worshiped hard. And we had a tremendous time. And they were followed by a number of other work camper groups that came in for a month at a time. In 1962, was a visitor's year. That was the year of the World's Fair in Seattle. And so we brought a lot of people in here that had come to Seattle to visit the fair. A lot of people from the flatlands of the Midwest and from Texas and California and everywhere. I think you people are due for a picture very quickly, aren't you?
The picture has been called off till 5 o'clock.
Till 5 o'clock.
But the orientation, of course.
I really have been hurrying through this thing really too fast to give you a good picture of it, because I thought it was under the pressure of about a half an hour. But maybe at this point you'd like to ask some questions about how this thing came about.
How it came about. I wondered, I read in West Beauty's book that you have diesel generators.
Yes.
And I wondered, how do you get the diesel fuel up there?
Well, that comes in on a freight barge. There's a barge that travels on the lake once a week.
Oh,
and we brought tanks up from Seattle, and the diesel was brought up on the barge and hauled by truck. And you see, at that time, there was a crane on the end of the dock. The dock that's there now wasn't there at the time we took over. There was a huge dock that went way out into the lake, and on the end of that dock, there was a huge crane. And that could lift the truck or tanks or whatever. It would lift 50 tons. So that was no problem.
And that's the way it works now?
Yes, and we found this two diesel units that we brought in here the first in 1961. We found those in Seattle. One of them had 4 hours of use on it. It had come from Alaska. And the other one had about 20 hours, so they were just like new. And we brought power into the village then about this time of the year in 1961.
And you're up on the slope here somewhere?
No, that's right along the road. On the right side, you'll see a little building down there about a quarter of a mile.
Oh.
On the right-hand side, yeah, that's the diesel plant, and that's used now as auxiliary power.
Oh, auxiliary power?
That's auxiliary power, but it was the primary power at that time.
And then you have
the hydropower was developed in 1963, the last year I was here.
And that's what you're using now?
And there's a man sitting back there that's has some share in that. He came to me one day and he says, where could you use $4,000? He says his church. He said his church in Michigan, I believe it was.
Ohio.
Ohio had some money they wanted to put into this thing, and where could I use $4,000? Well, I said, that's just about what it would take to build the light plant up there. And so that could easily be called the Wolf House up there.
Oh, that man over there.
The odd man sitting over there. I call him a wolf.
And the water, is it by gravity?
All from gravity. You can see the water tank up there at the mine level.
Uh-huh.
And the water for the hydro plant comes from a point 200 feet above the tank inlet. So if you want to take a good climb, go up to the upper level, and you'll see where we get our hydropower from. It drops 700 feet into that light plant and produces the power. And I think at 4 o'clock today, John is going to tell you about something about the future, Holden. And that may involve some more hydropower, and I hope it does, because this is something big that's coming up. I've heard about it. He'll probably say something more about it.
Were these mine shafts closed at the time you...
No, they were wide open. You could have walked in any time. We walked in there, and it's quite amazing what you would find in there. But we closed them soon after because there were some holes in there that if you fell into them, you would it'd take quite a while to reach bottom. And there are giant cathedrals within that mountain, stopes that are like a football stadium. And about 50 some miles of tunnels. It's quite a tremendous work. But you can imagine what a cavity it would take to fill this huge pile of tailings that's out here. Just imagine that took 20 years to build that. And a lot of the tailings are back in the mine into some of the pits that were left there. And that's why the water that comes out of there is polluted with cyanide. And it's poisonous, and you shouldn't be drinking it.
It's over there, but a new cover's selling all the rest of the water safe.
Right. So it's not a good, healthy place for people to drink up there, and the fish, too, don't like that water.
Mm. Did they build this place?
This building has been completely remodeled. This was a dormitory at the time we took it over. And this is quite a tremendous facility. You can see what it does for the people that come here and lecture. And there's been many a happy hour spent around this fireplace. Great. And the improvements that you see here, oh, there are so many. Many of the dormitories have been completely relined on the inside. There's new carpets and there's new siding and ceilings and new plumbing in many places. And the flowers that you see here, there were no flowers at the time except some daffodils that had survived the 3 years of abandonment. And we came in here that morning, there were daffodils in bloom around all the houses up above here. They had survived.
I imagine the snow was still here.
The only snow that was left in early June was some behind dorm one. It had fallen off the roof there, and there was a drift there that hadn't quite melted. We saw some evidence of that. But if you come in here in the wintertime, you'll know that the snow might be 8-10 feet deep. This is really a heavy snow area.
What about the mining property? Is it just going to be left? That is owned by Holden Village.
That's owned by Holden Village. We have deed to that property, and I don't think they'll ever revive the mining there because it's in very bad shape. It's completely flooded, and of course, if the price of gold that we have today was, if that had been true at the time we took it over, they would never have shut down. It was only because the price of copper went down to 25 cents that they closed the mine.
Gil, you might not have heard, it went up almost to 400 in the English market today.
Yeah, it's tremendous. Well, only 5% of their production here was gold. But even that, at $400 an ounce, oh, yeah. Wow. That would have bought a lot of hamburgers, wouldn't it?
Why don't we say the more about Holden today at 4, Gil is also going to be here, so your questions can either be about the future or the past, and we'll continue. Okay.